Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon, alongside St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co Recruitment in partnership with District 4. This podcast will explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century.
You and I both know that there are many sports, but football is the biggest sport in the world. My colleagues and I coming forward in that 2016 really shook up sport in terms of, look, we need to look at and get our act together, and we need to make sure that we're doing everything within our powers. And I've seen a massive change, absolutely giant strides we've made.
It's now time. This is the Community Safety Podcast. Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm Jim Nixon, and I've been involved in community safety for about 28 years. Today, the podcast is going to concentrate on safeguarding, and in particular, safeguarding in sport. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Stewart, a distinguished individual with a remarkable journey that extends behind his career in the Premier League as a footballer with clubs including Manchester City, Spurs and Liverpool. In 2016, he courageously stepped into the spotlight to disclose a deeply personal and painful experience from his childhood. Paul revealed that he had been the victim of sexual abuse by his football coach from the tender age of 10 to 14. His decision to share this profound and difficult truth not only showcases resilience, but also opened up important discussions about safeguarding young athletes and addressing the issue of abuse within the world of sport. Paul, thanks ever so much for agreeing to come on to the podcast today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Jim.
Just looking at your story and when you came out in 2016, which obviously was a big, big deal, and I remember the interviews back then that you completed. Can you share your initial thoughts and emotions when you decided to come forward and disclose the abuse that you suffered?
I think the most difficult thing was putting it out there and sort of almost losing your identity as a footballer and being an abuse victim. But for me, it was also, did I want to put my family through what the press will sort of put upon you in terms of interviews, and then sort of being right at the forefront. I'd finished playing football. I'd sort of dwindled into the universe without complications, and I was getting on with my own life. And then maybe I was a bit naive. Maybe. I just, I was in my own little bubble thinking, it was only maybe me. But once I stepped into that limelight, if you will, then the amount of individuals that sort of followed and came forward, and the problem, the extent of the problem in all four corners of the country and beyond, it was an overwhelming experience, and I needed to speak to my family to make sure that they were going to be okay with it first.
Yeah.
And then I was sort of on an emotional roller coaster because I thought that I'd done the wise thing by speaking to my family first and then going public. But it was just, it wasn't that simple. I mean, the repercussions on my family were massive, certainly my mum and dad and my two brothers, because they had no idea. And for them, it was a real, real like knife in the stomach, because you can only imagine that, I'm the youngest of three brothers. They think that they should have protected me. Parents, what they think they should have done to protect you also impacts on them. So I think a lot of people don't understand that whilst the abuse is horrendous on the individual that is on the receiving end, they don't really realise the impact it has on families and close friends and loved ones and how that really impacts them. So it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at the time, but I got through it. I was aware, because of my status within football, I was aware what the media were going to do, the questions that are difficult to answer, which really sell the press. But it was just that trying to process it myself.
Yeah.
Really.
Do you think maybe looking back that, and I know hindsight's easy, but maybe counselling for you, get your head round it before you then made that disclosure?
I'd never really thought about the counselling side of it, to be honest. And there was a reason why I didn't want to open a Pandora's box or be in a place worse than what I was already in. But yeah, then sure. When I looked back at it, I was already in a bad place. So I guess it wouldn't have really been any worse. But I just, that was my reasons, and that was why I was sort of against counselling.
With your parents, they clearly were groomed as well.
Yeah.
And they obviously thought this guy was a top bloke and had helped you with your career. I can imagine there was a lot of guilt going around from their point of view.
You're 100% right. You know, these people, they were master manipulators. It wasn't just grooming your parents. It was grooming the wider range of your family. You know, your grandparents, your aunties and uncles, they had to make sure that they positioned themselves in that place of trust, that everybody trusted them, so that nobody would then raise an eyebrow. This is the difference between back then and today with the phenomenon that we have, which is social media and the internet. Yeah. Do you know, that grooming now doesn't have to happen the same, because they can access our youngsters right through these platforms, that, you know, through social media and through the internet, without even speaking or having to groom parents and grandparents and the wider range of the family. And that's worrying, you know, that's the worrying aspect of how they can access our children now.
It's like you say, it's like that direct access. There's no real need to be able to sort of, you know, go through the immediate family, like with your experience and other young people back then. It was harder than, and I disclose the abuse, probably a lot more work.
You'll know yourself within the field that you've worked in for many years. You know, now, I think the statistics say within 6 weeks there's contact.
Yeah.
You know, we had an opportunity to use these social media platforms, to use the internet to educate people around safeguarding.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. It just became an area within which these people can operate and operate very, very cleverly.
As you well know.
I always say, you know, if these people concentrated on business, the way in which they concentrate on trying to access children.
Very manipulative.
They'll be some of the best business people in the country.
Child protection in sports has gained more attention in recent years, which is a really, really positive for me. How do you believe you've contributed to sort of, you know, getting that more on the map and ultimately protecting young people?
When I look back to 2016 now and the amount of individuals that came forward along with myself, it really did jolt sport into having to look at their safeguarding procedures and policies and the way in which they look after children. And it, I think, and I've seen the difference over the years, because I've continued to work within safeguarding. I've seen a massive shift, you know, in terms of how important that child's well-being, that child's, you know, the experience that they have when they're going through the journey. Do you know, and when you look at it, the children are only trying to fulfill their dreams. You know, for a child to have a dream and to pursue that dream is massive for that child. Maybe it was far too late for my generation, but when I look now and I look at how organisations have really come to the forefront, there's just, you know, there's just a massive, massive difference. You and I both know that there are many sports, but football is the biggest sport in the world. I think my colleagues and I coming forward in that 2016 really shook up sport in terms of, look, we need to look at and get our act together, and we need to make sure that we're doing everything within our powers. And I've seen a massive change. Absolutely giant strides we've made.
It is incredible, and you know, you've played a massive part in that, as well as, like you say, other professional sports people and footballers. But you know, beyond sport, what broader sort of societal changes do you believe, you know, are necessary to further protect children as we move forward?
It's the education. Safeguarding seems to have this It's a frightening word. You know, people see it as there's going to be complications. We're going to make their job more difficult by bringing in these procedures and policies. And it's on the contrary. For me, I think the biggest thing is, I mean, and I do an awful lot of safeguarding sessions with coaches, youngsters, you know, staff at clubs. It's the parents that I think we need to try and get to them, because I think parents still think that it happens somewhere else. It doesn't happen at our club, it happens over there. And, you know, I still see that they willingly drop their kids off at organisations without even doing the necessary checks on that organisation. You know, here often there's DBS checks and everyone's been DBS checked. But I don't think parents really understand that DBS checks are just a layer upon many other layers that are needed to make sure that safeguard is right. And in your work that you've done over the years, you know that a DBS check is only worth what it's worth on the day that they're checked. And if there's nothing on there, then that doesn't mean that they haven't done anything. It just means they've not been caught. And at that time, they haven't been caught. And this is why I think parents need to be more educated around what safeguarding is. Not just drop your child off at an organisation, not look at it as a free babysitting service where you can, you know, go off and leave them for a few hours. You need to really ask the questions. And, you know, I always say there are three simple questions, really, when you're dropping your child off. Is, you know, have you got a safeguarding policy? If so, where is it? And is it accessible?
Yeah.
Who do I contact if I have a problem? Have you got a number of somebody who I can contact? And I don't think that's asking a lot for a parent to do, but they're still reticent to ask them questions because they feel that they're challenging the organisation. And also some organisations, you know, they get their backs up because they think that somebody is challenging them by asking them questions.
Yeah, sure.
It's massively important. And, you know, if a parent goes up and asks the questions that have asked, their children will see that. And when they have children, it'll be an automatic thing that they do when they drop their kids off.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll just become something that's the norm instead of looking like we're challenging an organisation by asking them simple questions.
It always used to amaze me when my kids were growing up, you know, that some parents would be quite happy to send their kids to us like a sleepover. And they didn't even notice. Mm. I would never do that with my kids. I always made sure that we knew who they were, and you can never guarantee it. But it just amazes me sometimes where some parents, they're so busy and wrapped up in their own lives sometimes that they kind of just don't do the checks.
When we look at children, you know, we always seem too busy to do and speak to them, you know. Listen, I was guilty of it myself, you know. Mm. But my kids would come home from school and they're wanting to talk to you, and, you know, I was saying, I've got to do this or I've got to do that. And you find yourself not listening to your children. And that, again, the children's voice has got to be heard. You know, I call them children because that's what they are. They're athletes, they're footballers. No, they're not. They're 16 years of age, 18 years, they're still children. We need to understand that they're children. Not put monetary values on them, not call them footballers or athletes. Realise that they're children.
I think that's an absolutely spot-on point. I think there's an awful lot of pressure from some of these parents who want their kids to be premier footballers now. It must be, you know, and you must see this, immense at times.
You know, it's even worse now because when you look at it, and the pressure on a child can be massive because the rewards now are massive. They're not just setting themselves up for life, they're setting the whole families up for lives. So that's a pressure itself. And on a child, it would be easy for them to crumble under that pressure because, you know, if they're feeling it from not just the football club or whatever sports organisation, but from the parents and every angle, they're not going to enjoy it and they're going to be burnt out. Look, I see clubs taking him on as young as 4 years of age.
Right, isn't it?
You know, by the time they get to 11, they're fed up with football. You know, it's been coached out of them. The enjoyment's gone. They have this dream. And then at 18, they're just told, look, thanks, but you're not good enough. And all they've done is dream. We are then parting into society individuals that are not equipped to handle it because they've had this idea of becoming a top footballer, and then all of a sudden it's taken from under them.
What that then creates is a load of mental health issues. Particular group.
We're releasing them into society, not equipped, you know. Yeah. And it won't surprise you that this is why they go into crime or they end up in jail, because they really aren't equipped to go into what we call normal society and contribute. That the impact on their mental health is massive.
You can see why they would probably go down that route of crime, because that's the alternative to riches.
Even worse, you know, they take their own lives.
Given what you went through, Paul, are you shocked that you had the career that you did, given what you experienced as a young lad?
Do you know what? When I look back at it, I don't see it. I look at the amount of games I played for Liverpool, and I genuinely thought I was good enough not to play 32 times, but 332 times. I would have liked to have played more times for England, and I think I was good enough to do so, but probably say this, you know, as a youngster, football was my safe haven. So when I was on that football pitch, that was the only place I didn't think I could get hurt. I could always get myself ready for a game, but because I felt safe on there, once the final whistle blows, I endured my problems, not just as a youngster, but then as I got older, because I wasn't on the safety of the pitch. So I think I had a half-decent career, but I think it fell short of what it could have been had I, what's around today, to think that I could go and speak, go and talk to somebody, yeah, share my problems. I think I would have had a better football career than I had. In saying that, the football field was my safe haven, and it was a place where I didn't feel that anyone could hurt me. So I was able to perform because of that.
Looking back, what advice would you give to a young Paul Stewart?
Just to talk to somebody. Now, the difficulty is who that person is. We always have somebody that we can go to and that we can trust. Dad or your mum, it might be somebody totally different, but you start that journey of talking. You open up. The game and sport has changed now. The chances do not get inhibited because they've spoke up. You know, I mean, coaches, staff around clubs, they're all versed in safeguarding to a certain level. Could be the physio.
Yeah.
It could be the woman that
could be anybody that you trust.
Yeah. But the most important thing is you're struggling with whatever it is, not just what happened to me. And I say, if it's the minor thing, you're struggling with homework at school,
yeah,
you know, go and speak to somebody, because to go out on that football field and all you're concentrating on is the game ahead, the tactics that you've been told, you're playing with a smile on the face. I say, you play better football, you'll be a better athlete. I don't care what your issues are, how big or how small. If you talk to somebody, it might not be put right overnight, but you will be able to share it and you'll feel better within yourself by doing so. There's nothing worse than bottling something up, because all it does, and you can be unaware of it, is manifest itself into other formats, whether you're angry on the field, whether your disciplinary record is bad. And it will come out in other ways. But if you share the problem, then you will find that you'll feel more comfortable. It'll be like a weight off your shoulders. And then going out on that football field and performing will be a doddle for you.
I think mentoring and early intervention for me is really, really important. And like what you've just said has just really sort of backed that up for me. As you saw from your own story, once you're off that field, you tended to sort of reach out sort of to drugs and alcohol, didn't you, to sort of kill the pain, I suspect.
Yeah. I took my first line of cocaine. I thought all my problems were answered. Little did I know that just compounds them, because you start going after more and more to find that buzz again that isn't there. And then when you come down, you're actually in 10 times a worse place than you were before you took it. I then get even lower, and therefore I'd need to go again to pick myself up. It was perpetual and totally out of control, whereby everything now becomes even more heightened because you're under the influence of drink and drugs, which totally changes your whole mentality.
Was there another turning point around the drinking drugs for you?
I think it was life or death. I was causing so much problems at home with my wife. Everyone was suffering because of my drug habit, and I thought, you're going to kill yourself.
Sure.
Then you need to make sure that your loved ones are okay, and I'm just putting them through hell, and I couldn't carry on doing it. I'd either have to walk away and end my marriage or go and get myself clean. And I was fortunate that my wife stood by me, came to my very first appointment with the counsellor, the drugs counsellor, came a number of times with me to support me and help me get through it and clean. I had to get myself right first before I could then start to look after my family and be the father and husband that I should be. My wife supported me right the way down the line, because if I'd have been her, I would have just called it a day and kicked me out and,
yeah,
you know, gone our separate ways because of what I put her through. But I was fortunate she didn't do that.
And again, in some ways, like another form of mentoring, really, isn't it? Without her, you probably wouldn't have done it.
Probably wouldn't. And you know what? You realise then how strong other individuals are, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not only what they're putting through, but then they're prepared to, like, wipe the slate clean and support you. And, you know, you then realise how strong your partner, your wife, your loved ones are.
How long did it take you to get yourself completely free of drugs, Paul?
Well, I stopped as soon as I went to the first appointment.
All right, okay. That's interesting.
I stopped doing them and found to stop doing them. It was a struggle, as you can imagine. I had to go through the cold turkey as well, which is not pleasant. But sometimes you're told to go and see a psychiatrist or a counsellor, and sometimes you just don't hit it off. You know, there isn't that connection.
That chemistry.
Yeah, I was lucky, you know, the gentleman that I went to see, he just seemed to get me, and he said things that made sense, and I was fortunate that we had that connection as well. So I went through it twice, once when I played and once when I finished, I went back on. He just gave me the coping mechanisms, and when I thought about doing it, or if it came through my head what I should do to help myself not go down that road, because you have a choice, don't you? You may have seen in my book, it was left or right turn for me. I would go left to go home or right to go on my cocaine friends in the pub, and I managed to stay left and left, and I'm fortunate that I did.
During your football career, you obviously just said, yeah, there was a couple of occasions, but did that create conflict with some of your managers around, you know, did that have an impact?
Whilst I probably thought I was hiding it from them, I think they had an idea, and I think that's why Ted Venables probably sold me when he did to Liverpool. I think, you know, because I was going out in London and partying and so forth and so on. So despite the fact that they got a good offer from Liverpool, I think he probably knew that I was getting up to things I shouldn't have been off the field. And you know, I was loud in training, you know, you could smell the alcohol. It doesn't, you know, when I look back now, it doesn't take a scientist to guess that something wasn't right.
And I presume that sort of followed you up to Liverpool, really, and soon as was the manager there,
when I look back, probably my worst time was Liverpool, you know, just what could have been the best move ever became a living hell. You know, I'm coming back up north and I'm back with where all my family are, and you know, I'm at one of the biggest clubs in the world, and you know, all that was there, but all I wanted to do was get this kick of drugs to take away the darkness that I just felt when I wasn't playing. I just felt I was always, you know, it was always darkness, you know, and I never really put two and two together and knew it was because of what happened to me as a child, you know, because I'd had a decent career. I thought I'd blocked it all away, you know, but you know, when I look back now with this head on my shoulders, I realise that most of my issues were based on what happened to me as a child, and it was just trying to mask it and, you know, put a Band-Aid over the top instead of actually fixing it completely.
What is a typical day of darkness like?
Depression. And then it was wearing a mask and a cloak and performing to individuals of being somebody that you're totally not. Fear of going into places where people would look at you. It was many things that are difficult, you know, fighting yourself constantly, wanting to say and show love and affection, but then actually doing the opposite. And criticising, yeah, you know, in your head, you're talking about something else. So everything that you would find normal would be majorly difficult for me to do. And, you know, if I was in a mind of not seeing anyone, then I would be rude to them, but I didn't want to be rude. So you were constant battling with yourself, your emotions, of you, what you wanted to do, what were inside, but actually what came out was completely the opposite.
Like living a complete lie, really.
Yeah, yeah, an absolute lie, yeah. And that compounds everything as well, you know, because you can't seem to function because you're going through this black hole that the harder you try, the darker it gets, and then the worse your behaviour becomes because you're trying to get out of it, and you'll use any method, whether it be drink, drugs, or anything, to try and come out of that scenario that you've probably put yourself in.
And when you've talked to other footballers, because I know around the same time that you sort of came out, there were other footballers that came out. Have they kind of shared very similar experiences?
Do you know what? And it's not just footballers. I mean, because I speak to a lot of individuals that haven't played the game that have struggled. And do you know what? I put us in separate rooms and ask us to write down, you know, the effects of it all, and then match them up, and you'd probably get, you know, 80% that would be exactly the same, and that doesn't actually just have to be the sexual abuse. You know, it can be racial abuse. It can be anything.
But really positive that, you know, you've come out of it. You know, and you're in a much better place now, and that must make you feel as an individual, you know, quite proud of yourself.
I get to talk about my story. For me, the work that I do helps me. I don't say anything for 42 years. Then all of a sudden, I'm sort of recounting it every time I do a safeguarding session.
Your release, isn't it?
And that, I think, has been my journey to sort of getting through it. I never quite believed that it would go away totally, because I think, I'd be naive to think that would happen. But the fact that I can talk about it, and I do constantly, helps me.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed now as well, and what I've, since I've been doing this, because it's been 6 years, is I know if I don't feel right as well, and because of where I operate, I've made so many friends that I can just pick the phone up and, you know, talk to them. And you know what you do? You often don't talk about, you know, the problem that you've got. It's just talking. And I think that's why I'm always saying to youngsters, you know, I don't care what your issue is, just talk about it. Just talk about it. And I'm not saying that it will be sorted there and then, but you will feel tons better. And for me, that's what it is. I feel better for being able to talk about something that I'd not spoke about for 42 years.
I can see how you get that tonic.
You also get that exuberance and that feeling of that you've helped somebody. And you know what? I took a lot from the game. All I did was take from the game. So for me now, it's giving something back to the game that gave me an awful lot.
Yeah.
You know, I never appreciated it, and I didn't really realize what a privileged position I was in at the time, because I was so wrapped up in myself. Now I look at it and I feel like I'm giving something back to the sport, and hopefully just giving them youngsters some tools that help them on the journey that they're embarking on, because it isn't an easy journey.
No, you know, especially now.
Especially now, but it isn't an easy journey. It comes with its challenges, and that's why I say to them, if there are any other problems, talk about them, because it's hard enough to make your way in the game now. Often we're competing against our best friend for his position, their position. They are challenges is why we played the game. So don't carry any other baggage that is unnecessary.
It's hard enough, isn't it?
It's hard enough.
Yeah.
It's hard enough to make your way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it comes back to what you were saying earlier. You know, I think sometimes when you're in that, some players, the money is a big attraction now, isn't it? And I would reckon, and I don't know what your views on this, but I think some players probably get to the point where they stop enjoying it.
I still believe that players go out there, you know, 99.9% of them go out there because they love football. The monetary side of it is just something that has changed.
I hope so. I hope you're right.
They can't control. And I'd like to think, I call it the 5-3 feeling, because we used to kick off at 3 o'clock back then and stood in the tunnel at 5-3. Do you know, you can't, nothing can pay for that. Nothing can emulate that. And that is why we played it.
Never had that privilege, but I can imagine that is a great feeling. I was just going to ask you about the media and the role that the media play in safeguarding. Do you think they do enough?
And, you know, the problem you have with the media is it's all about the story. And they're in a dog-eat-dog world where they have to get the best story. Unfortunately, there are some elements of that media that will get that story and not care about the individual on the receiving end of the story, and they won't care about their mental well-being. They won't care about that individual. It's all about the story. And unfortunately, that is part and parcel of when you enter into, you know, a sport like football or like cricket or whatever it is. You've got to understand that these people are ruthless and they will get into you. And I say to the youngsters, you have to have a strong constitution. Once the media get into you, and they will not let it go. And you know, I don't think that the media for 1 minute care about safeguarding over and above a story.
Yeah, they need to do more, but their objectives are different to yours and mine, aren't they, at the end of the day?
Totally.
I want to talk about you in your present day, really. You've talked a little bit about, you know, what you do. Could you elaborate a bit more in terms of, you know, what your sort of week looks like in terms of the work you do out in the field?
Yeah, well, I deliver safeguarding awareness sessions for the EFL, but it has actually grown organically since I started, where I do the premiership and I do outside, I do businesses. But my typical week is really, I will go to a football club. I will address either the staff from the football club, the scholars, the first team, sometimes the owners and the board members.
Okay.
And when I first started this, what happened was people were inviting me to go and tell my lived experience story. And what I wasn't comfortable with it because, and the reason being was people used to feel sorry for me and pity me because of what happened. But was I really educating them? Was I helping them in their journey, so to speak? So I took a step back and I went and educated myself. I did all the courses that you could within safeguarding, right up to the highest level. And what that did was it gave me the knowledge and it gave me an understanding of safeguarding. You've got to understand, and you'll know this, that there was no such word as safeguarding when I played. There was not even a duty of care. So safeguarding, I wanted to understand what the landscape was, so I chose to study and take the courses that you can to educate yourself around it. And then what I did, I put something together that it does incorporate my survivor's story.
Yeah.
But that's only half of it. The rest of it is educating youngsters around the dangers of social media. You know, dressing room banter, for instance. Is it dressing room banter or, you know, are we bullying?
Yeah.
Is it bullying and is it abuse? And so I chose to sort of put something together whereby I can educate them and give them some tools that will hopefully help them when they're, you know, going through the stages of trying to achieve being a top athlete and a sports person. And it seems to have worked. And I'm going over to Italy this month to speak to a Serie A club about it. I've been to Poland. I got invited to Jamaica. So it really has grown organically from not just football, but I speak to a lot of organisations. And then, obviously, the University of Salford, I've been working with them for some 4 or 5 years now, and they awarded me the doctorate for the work that I've done within safeguarding. So, do you know, it has totally changed my life, and I could be out there every day, but I have to make sure that my well-being's all right. There's no point in me standing there and talking to an audience about safeguarding and well-being when if I'm not right. So yeah. I do look after myself, but do you know, I've made it my vocation in life to carry on and do this. I enjoy it, especially if I think that I've helped somebody along the way.
Yeah, I always say, you know, when I was policing in particular, you make a difference to one person. You've done your job, haven't you? You know, you've made that difference. You know, you may have prevented that young person from becoming a victim.
You'll be surprised at how many come up to me and then they'll speak about something that might have happened to them, and then you'll find them thanking you because you gave them the strength to do so. And do you know, that's what makes the job worthwhile, because do you know, truthfully, to relive in your childhood, you know, if you're not your mental well-being isn't right, you can put yourself in a dangerous place, and I'm aware of that.
Of course you are.
I come away from some places and I've had people come up to me and been able to speak out, or they'll contact me afterwards and say, thanks, Pete. You know, I've spoken to my partner, or I've spoken to somebody, and then I go, that's why I do it. That's why I do it, because I don't want to turn the tally on in 20 years' time, you know, and look at a glutton of individuals from whatever walk of life bearing the souls because we haven't learned our lesson. And if I can help somewhat or be a part of that change, then so be it, because I can't change my past, you know, and I often say I can't change what happened. It's done. And if I dwell on it, that gives that my abuser more of a hold over me. What I can do is try and influence the future, and all I do is look positively forward rather than what's happened now in my past.
Yeah. It's your vocation after football, isn't it?
It is. And then I never thought that it would happen. You know, I thought I'd take the story that now is widely known to my grave, but just so happens that what happened in 2016 has then changed my life completely. And I hope, whilst people want to listen to me, then I'll continue to do the journey. And what I do is I also look at what the current athlete, footballer, child faces today. No, there's no point in me talking about the mid-70s because, as you know, the way in which these people operate is totally different now. Yeah. So I have to make sure that when I'm speaking, it's what the modern-day player faces as he's going through that journey, or she's going through that journey, or the athlete. And that's what's good about it, because it's forever evolving.
Absolutely, and it has to. If we're going to educate and keep educating, we have to evolve with the times. It's as simple as that.
And you'll know that the harder we're working to stop these people, they're working twice as hard to try and access our youngsters. Yeah. Because that's, you know, it's not an illness that you can rectify with medication or anything like that. It's something that's there constantly.
And it will never go away.
What that means is they're going to try every means to access our youngsters.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. I couldn't let you go without mentioning the book Damaged. Not an easy read, I've got to say, but I think it's, again, part of that education. And I think, you know, I wanted to just mention that and sort of get it out onto the podcast, because I think people need to read it. You know, if you're involved in safeguarding or you're a parent or whatever, you need to read that book.
And that's what I wanted to do with it. You know, it could have been just another autobiography of a footballer and the funny stories, the goals, the ups and downs. But I didn't want to do that. You know, when I did it, I wanted it to be something that could help people, them, you know, make people understand, you know, that it doesn't just affect the individual, the person that's being abused, how it can affect families, loved ones, and just be as raw and honest as I can with it and make it a journey. And to be honest with you, I say this an awful lot. I have England caps. I have FA Cup winners' medals, championship medals. You know, I'm more proud of that book than any of the medals, the caps and that, purely and simply because they just represent the heartache and pain that I have strived to achieve them. You know, it was at too much of a cost. The book is something that hopefully, you know, for years to come will help people and help them understand how they operate, what can happen, and how it can affect people, and how it can devastate lives.
Not just yours either, all the people around you. It wasn't just about you, it was about the wider network, your family.
Yeah.
It affected so many people.
It's a
harrowing read, but as I said, it's one that you really need to pick up and read. It's available in all good bookstores and on Amazon. Highly recommend that. Paul, I can't thank you enough for this hour. I personally got a lot from it. I know the audience will get an awful lot from it, so I can't thank you enough for that. For me, you're an inspiration, mate, you know, and just keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. If you've liked this episode, please follow us, rate, and leave a 5-star review if you can. And we'll catch you on next episode.
Alongside support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co Recruitment in partnership with District 4, you have been listening to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.